From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Rosemary Kennedy died in January of 2005. The biographer Kate Clifford Larson saw the obituary in the Boston Globe, and the notice surprised her. There wasn't much to it, just the basics. She knew what most of us know. Rosemary suffered from some kind of intellectual disability, and that she had been lobotomized and institutionalized by her parents. But Larson wanted to know the rest. She says Rosemary is treated as a peripheral member of the Kennedy family, an outlier. But in writing a book, a project that took on a personal dimension, she found that Rosemary's story became a reckoning for the Kennedys, and it influenced millions of lives. Kate Clifford Larson is joining us today to talk about Rosemary Kennedy. We invite you to join us after the news.
Spring has sprung, and KUER's community calendar has the best ways to celebrate the season. Plan your next adventure or outing at KUER.org under the Events tab. And if you own or manage an organization, submit your next donor gathering, fundraising event, or community meeting. Plan your weekend or submit your event by visiting the KUER community calendar under the Events tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The subtitle of Kate Clifford Larson's book about Rosemary Kennedy, The Hidden Kennedy Daughter, tells you what most of us know about her. The biographer Doris Kearns Goodwin was among the first to reveal some of the particulars of Rosemary's story, the extent of her intellectual disabilities, the fact that she had undergone a lobotomy, but really not much else has been written, or had been written anyway. Rosemary came to be seen as a peripheral member of the Kennedy family, but the more Kate Clifford Larson learned, the more she came to see Rosemary as being at the center of this dynamic family story. And so that's where she puts her in her new book. When she began, she figured in the 21st century, the particulars of this story of a family member who had intellectual and mental impairment was no longer something to hide, but it was more complicated than that. And Larson says she was able to paint a disturbing portrait that revealed troubling attitudes that led to, of course, tragic decisions. Today in the program, she's joining us to talk about what she found. Rosemary, the Hidden Kennedy Daughter is the full title of the book. Kate Clifford Larson is a writer and historian. She's written biographies of Mary Surratt and Harriet Tubman, and she's joining us today from a studio outside of Boston. And Kate Clifford Larson, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's begin with when you first started paying attention to this story, and I guess it was, as you mentioned it in the book, when you first saw her obituary. This was back in 2005?
Right. In January 2005, she died, and there was a three-paragraph obituary in the Boston Globe. And it just, you know, sort of hit me. It's sad, but still a little mysterious. You know, everybody was aware of Rosemary, but, you know, none of us knew really what happened to her and what her full story was. So it inspired me to look into her life story in any way that I could.
Why did you figure, at least at first, it was that we didn't know much? Because that seems surprising in 2005, that we didn't really know that much.
Well, the reality is, because she really had been hidden for a very long time, yeah. And then when she was sort of revealed to the public, back in the 1970s, her real story still was not exposed until Doris Kearns Goodwin revealed in her book in the 1980s that Rosemary had undergone a lobotomy and it had completely disabled her. And then that sort of was it. Any other book that was written about the Kennedy family just sort of repeated what Doris had written. But fortunately, when I started researching the book, I had access to the Kennedy Library and newly opened collections of papers.
It wasn't long into this project that your son, who was 19 at the time, was diagnosed with schizophrenia. And in some ways, it's interesting, you sort of found yourself facing a circumstance that wasn't really all that different. In many ways, it was different, but in some ways, it wasn't that different from what the Kennedy parents, Joe and Rose, were facing, at least in terms of how are we going to sort of deal with all of this? Would you talk about that sort of personal element and how that made you think about and write about this story?
Sure. I was 2 years into the project researching when my son Trevor was diagnosed, and it just sent us all into a tailspin. It's one of the most serious mental illnesses, and resources are difficult to find, and those that are available are very expensive. And struggling with him just made me look at Joe and Rose Kennedy in a different light. Yeah. I had started down this path of being very critical of them and their treatment of Rosemary. But then I had an appreciation of what parents go through trying to find resources to help their children who have disabilities. But then over time, I returned to being critical, having experienced the things that I did as a parent and knowing that my husband and I would do anything to help our son. I just started looking at Joe and Rose with a different lens. And part of that was not attractive to me.
Yeah. It's interesting to me how much of a story, how much of a part that, I mean, it's obvious in some ways, and she's not the central figure, but how much of a role, of course, Rose Kennedy plays in all of this. Would it be fair to say the book is also very much a story of Rose Kennedy?
It absolutely is. It's a story of Rose becoming a woman and a mother, and how the things that happened to her shaped the way she raised her children and the way she treated Rosemary. And I think in order to understand Rosemary's story, you have to understand her mother and what her mother went through and who she was as a person.
She's a paradoxical figure in some ways, because you write about how Rose Kennedy had these really modern aspirations for a woman of that time. She was intent on getting this good education. And then there's this kind of ironic twist to it. Her father initially said, yes, you can go to college, or at least this secular Wellesley College. And she's really excited. But then the day before she's to go to college, he pulls the rug out from under her. And as you put it in the book, Rose came to understand that her father had chosen his politics over her future. In the context of Rosemary's story, that's such an ironic twist.
It is so ironic because, of course, Joe and Rose chose the futures of their sons over Rosemary's health.
On the other hand, she was also deeply devoted to Catholicism. As opposed to going to Wellesley, then she goes to Catholic schools. And you say that it molded her into a more conservative and devout Catholic. Would you explain the importance of that part? Because you say the way this story develops, it seems like, as you say in the book, it forever circumscribed her future with her husband and her children, her faith. And so it must have played a powerful influence on the way that she dealt with it, Rosemary and the rest of the kids.
Right. Rose did become far more devout after her father had refused her wish to go to Wellesley College. And I think it was a way for Rose to take control of her life and immerse herself in this worldview of becoming a perfect mother and daughter and wife. And so everything that she did from then on, it was sort of within that framework. And Catholicism gave her a path to doing that. It also gave her tremendous strength to survive, you know, the death of four of her sons or children, and also a philandering husband, and then the disappearance of another daughter. So, you know, there are good parts and bad parts to her incredible devotion to Catholicism.
It's interesting. She had this yearning, as you say, for active engagement in something important outside, you know, of this, you know, her just being a mother. And she reaches this breaking point that you write about near the end of her fourth pregnancy. She moves out. What's going on? What happens?
Clearly, she's upset with Joe. She's feeling consumed by being a mother at home, and her husband is out at night more and more, and he's busy with his public life. And Rose, who was such a political being herself as the daughter of a famous politician in Massachusetts and in Boston, she's finally frustrated and she can't cope anymore. So she flees to her parents' house while she's pregnant with their fourth child, their daughter Kathleen.
Right.
And her father says, you know, you chose this life, pick yourself up, and you go back to your husband and you make a life for yourself.
Yeah.
And so she does. And that just kind of sends her on this mission of being the perfect mother and the perfect wife, even though her husband was certainly not a perfect husband.
Right. And there's another paradox in here. During the 20s and the 30s, Rose and Joe, well, Rose would go off on these long trips away from her family. What do you make of that?
So, you know, she would give birth to another child. They had nine children.
Yeah.
And she would go off on extended vacations and leave the new baby and all the children at home with nurses and governesses. And Joe would sort of have responsibility of running the household. And she would just relax and enjoy herself. And this became a lifelong habit. The vacations would be longer, and she would go abroad and to South America and Europe. And she had her own life and her own way of coping with her disappointments and the things in her life that she couldn't control anymore.
There's an important context for this story also. The Kennedy family, when Rosemary was born, Rosemary, of course, is the third child. The family was just getting established, certainly on the rise. Joseph Kennedy, Joe Kennedy, is an up-and-comer. He's working these crazy hours but making a name for himself. And I guess it would be fair to say that Joe Kennedy had this chip on his shoulder. I mean, he was really good at making money, but he was also looking for social status. And that's an important – the idea of these optics of how, you know, how things looked, this was an important way of understanding this story, it seems.
Absolutely. They were an up-and-coming, young, Irish Catholic couple and family with good political kind of ancestral stock. And Joe wanted to – you know, reach the pinnacle of American political, social, and economic life. But as an Irish Catholic in Boston in particular, there was just so far that he could go. And he resented the Protestant elite who ran everything in Boston and Massachusetts. And he wanted to break out and make a name for himself and show, you know, those Brahmin Yankees that he could be as good, if not better, than all of them. So that defined the way Rose and Joe wanted their family to appear in public as well. And that affected how Rosemary was raised and the choices that they made for her.
There's the story you tell of Joe Kennedy's strong reaction when Gloria Swanson, she's the film star who was carrying on this extramarital affair with him, but she asked about Rosemary's condition. And Joe's reaction was really pretty intense. Would you want to talk about that?
Right. He was on the phone. She was with him, and he was on the phone with a doctor at a hospital in Boston. Yeah. And he was saying, you know, I'll give you all this money if you just like cure Rosemary. And clearly the doctor on the other end of the line was saying, you know, we can't cure her. And Joe was furious. So he hangs up and Gloria asks him what's wrong with Rosemary. And he sort of flips out on her and says, don't ever talk to me about her and don't ever bring her up again. And it shocked Gloria. She had never seen him be angry before. And Joe's secretary, his assistant, turned to her. His name was Eddie Moore. And he, you know, motioned to her that Rosemary was intellectually disabled and that Joe never wanted to talk about her and that Gloria should drop it.
But what did
she did?
Right. Right. She did. What did Joe and what did Rose think? How did they explain it? I mean, trying to imagine in some ways how Rose would have explained it. I mean, she was deeply devout in her faith. How did she explain why this had happened to her, what God had done to her, or how God had allowed this to happen? How did she explain it, and how did Joe explain it?
You know, early on, I think that they looked for many different explanations. When they were younger, they said that they thought that it was scarlet fever that had caused Rosemary's intellectual disabilities. But once science, you know, kind of expanded and started understanding what happens during the birth process, they realized that Rosemary had been sort of damaged during birth because the nurse held baby Rosemary back in the birth canal for about 2 hours. So she probably suffered from a lack of oxygen. But then later on, Rose and Joe just wanted to deny that Rosemary was intellectually disabled.
Yeah.
And that was a whole part of their lives that they sort of manufactured this life that wasn't real when it centered around Rosemary. And it put a lot of pressure on Rosemary to perform and meet expectations that she could not meet.
So what could you find in Rose Kennedy's diaries that told you, gave you any insight about the way Rose was thinking about it? Because you say she rarely mentioned Rosemary in her diaries.
It is very strange. She rarely mentions Rosemary. Partly, as I came to understand, because they sent Rosemary away when she was 11 years old to a series of boarding schools, she wasn't around as much as the other children. And also, I think that Rose took greater joy in her son's accomplishments and the things that they were doing than the girls. But also the girls, other than Rosemary, Kathleen and Eunice, Pat and Jean, they were smarter and more capable. They had more abilities, and they did more things, so Rose wrote about them. But Rosemary, she is very, very quiet about, very silent about, very rarely mentions her, which is very tragic.
Yeah. Let's back up to 1918 when Rosemary is born. You mentioned some of the circumstances of her birth. Let's talk a little bit about that. But first, let's sort of lay some groundwork here about what was going on at the time. This is the time when the Spanish influenza pandemic was sweeping the globe. But just point out how intense that was, how serious that was. You talk about how tens of millions of people had died at this time.
Right. The Spanish influenza had already made a sweep around the globe and killed millions of people, and it was making a second pass around the globe just as World War I was ending.
Yeah.
It was just horrific, and it was killing millions more. And in September of 1918, it had hit Boston again, and thousands of people were dying, and thousands more were in hospitals. And Rose's obstetrician was at the hospital at the time that she went into labor, and he was trying to take care of many of these patients that were flooding the hospital. And so he was delayed getting to her when she went into labor and called for him to come help deliver the baby. And that's when the tragic decision was made by the obstetrical nurse who was assisting Rose to hold the baby back until the doctor could arrive.
You really feel for the nurse, though. I mean, as you point out, she's in this really untenable position. I mean, she's trained to deliver the baby. She's responsible for the health of the mother and the baby. But she's also expected for kind of creepy reasons. I mean, the doctor needed to make the money. He had to deliver so she couldn't do it. So she's in an impossible place.
She is. She is. And tragically, they didn't know that there could be damage done to a baby if you hold the baby back. You know, they didn't make the connection between lack of oxygen and childbirth with later developmental or intellectual or even physical disabilities. So she's just thinking, well, Rose can suffer a little bit longer until the doctor comes.
She held Rose Kennedy's legs together. Then when that didn't seem to be working, she grabbed onto the baby's head and tried to force it back into the birth canal. And this went on for 2 hours.
That's what was reported. That's right. I can't imagine it myself.
No. So can we say, though, with any certainty that Rosemary Kennedy's intellectual disabilities came as a result of that? Do we have any way of even connecting it for sure?
We have no idea. Yeah. It seems plausible and highly likely, but we have no idea. I do know that it wasn't caused from scarlet fever, because Rosemary got scarlet fever when she was 5, but her intellectual disabilities had long been identified before that. So, you know, we can look for answers. There might be other reasons, but at least we can look to this one event as a highly probable cause for Rosemary's intellectual disabilities.
Kate Clifford Larson is with us. Her book is Rosemary, the Hidden Kennedy Daughter. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're telling the story of the one Kennedy child who's mostly been forgotten. President Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, Senator Ted Kennedy, not to mention the remarkable sisters, have gotten their share of the attention. But The historian and biographer Kate Clifford Larson got to wondering about Rosemary, their other sister, who was born with intellectual disabilities. This is a tragic story. To keep up appearances, among other complicated reasons, Rosemary was lobotomized at the age of 23, sent off to an institution, abandoned, really, is not too harsh a way of putting it. She didn't see her mother, Rose Kennedy, for 20 years after the procedure. The book is called Rosemary, the Hidden Kennedy Daughter. Kate Clifford Larson is joining us to talk about it. So you kind of wince when you read the way people at that time were referring to people with intellectual disabilities. Rose once wrote, mm-hmm. I had never heard of a retarded child. That was just one of the clumsy words you heard at the time. What were some of the other idiot and imbecile and moron? I mean, what was the understanding at the time of intellectual disability?
Very limited understanding. And there was a lot of stigma attached to people with intellectual disabilities and to the families, frankly. They suffered as much as well, which is unfortunate. It was just a time when people didn't understand, nor did they really care to understand.
Eugenics movement was sort of having a moment at the time. This idea that the disabled were defectives, which, you know, Rockefeller believed this and Carnegie believed this and Teddy Roosevelt believed this.
Right. And they had sterilization programs to sterilize people with disabilities. It was a pretty horrific time.
Did she get an actual legitimate diagnosis, Rosemary, do we think?
I have no idea. Her medical records are sealed because of HIPAA laws specifically. Yeah. And so we don't know what the doctors in the 1920s and 1930s were writing down and thinking that they were diagnosing about Rosemary. There were a few clues in letters at the Kennedy Library. There was one doctor who was a famous endocrinologist, and he decided, or he had determined, that hormones affected the intellectual and physical development of teenagers. And he convinced Rose and Joe to submit Rosemary to weekly hormone injections, and he promised them that she would be cured of her intellectual disabilities in 9 months. And of course, that wasn't going to happen. Yeah. And she was not cured. But the poor young teenage girl had to endure these hormone injections for actually, it ended up being about 2 years. So I can't imagine what they did to her body and her brain, and just terrible to think about.
It's interesting to sort of watch you in the book piece together what could have been some kind of diagnosis. I mean, she couldn't tell her left from her right. Which mm-hmm. you figure maybe there's a little bit of dyslexia, although you say that doesn't explain all of the other things that were going on. Some of her brothers and sisters thought she suffered from seizures too.
Right. And she could have had all of these things.
Yeah.
She there was this mirror writing that she did, and the difficulty telling the difference between right and left, directions. She couldn't cope with directions. And then Eunice, in several interviews, talked about, as children, watching Rosemary have seizures, and all the other kids would be moved to another room or sent outside while doctors came and would give Rosemary a shot, and then she would calm down and the incident would be over and the parents would never talk about it. So, you know, did she have epilepsy? It's hard to say. Who knows?
So there's a lot of pressure on that. I mean, you mentioned that there's, at the time, the distinction between the intellectually disabled and the mentally ill. There was rarely there wasn't a distinction, I suppose, at that time that they could talk about.
Right. So, the options for Rose and Joe were few and far between. You know, institutions were filled with people who were, frighteningly insane or just merely physically disabled, and then those who were intellectually disabled along a wide spectrum of abilities. And they certainly didn't want that for their daughter. And they didn't have many choices. However, you know, they did try. They hired tutors to work with her and teach her the school lessons that she was unable to complete in school because she just was not of the same ability level as her peer group. So they did try, but I think they just eventually, as they had more children and their other children are so active and mm-hmm. bright and moving forward, Rosemary was, I think, viewed as a little bit of a drag on the family momentum moving forward.
Yeah. So they reached this crisis point. I think you referred earlier to the fact that she was 11 when she was sent away to a boarding school. And this was interesting, too. It seems like, I don't know, I can't quite tell what Rose was doing in her communications with these schools. What was she actually telling them about the reality of Rosemary's condition? Because it seems like she was kind of holding back on what the realities might have actually been with her daughter.
Right. She actually was definitely holding back and not telling them the truth about Rosemary's capabilities. The first school that they sent her to was actually a school for children with intellectual disabilities. But the Kennedys became frustrated after 2 years. They didn't see that Rosemary was learning any more than she had the 2 years before. So they felt that Rosemary had an attitude problem and that she was responsible for not learning. So they sent her to regular boarding schools, some of them Catholic boarding schools, but they didn't reveal the truth to the teachers or the administrators about Rosemary's problems or issues and left it up for those teachers to figure it out on their own. And of course, those schools weren't about to send Rosemary home because the Kennedys were very powerful, very important Catholics. So they just kept Rosemary in these schools, but they were the wrong setting for her. She could not compete. She couldn't do the lesson plans, and she just got more and more frustrated.
And she went through, what was it, 5 schools in 7 years, was that?
That's right.
Yeah.
5 schools in 7 years. That's hard on a child who and a young teenager who has intellectual disabilities. As with many children with disabilities, they suffer from anxiety, especially change is, you know, very difficult. And to change schools for Rosemary that many times really destabilized her quite frequently. And mental health issues began to appear during her teen years. Right. And those were just exacerbated by all these frequent changes that were made to her.
1937, Joe Kennedy scores this high-profile position as ambassador to Britain, Great Britain. And in many ways, you know, this kind of signaled, I mean, you know, he is a striver, Joe Kennedy, and this kind of signals that he had made it. But this also required a kind of, as you and you write about this, a kind of social performance, which meant parading the children. And the kids really became props. Talk about this, if you would.
The family all went to London and moved into the ambassador's residence, and it was an incredible moment for the Kennedys because this was the first Irish Catholic person to be appointed to that post. And Rose was thrilled because as this political being, she knew that she'd be on a world stage and she would have to perform the duties as the ambassador's wife and that her children would have to really be perfect. Mm-hmm. And so that was a challenge with so many children, certainly, but also with Rosemary, who they had tried to keep out of the public eye because they didn't want people to know that she had these disabilities. Mm. But she would be very much in the public once they arrived in London. So it was this constant dance. I look at it as a dance of trying to keep Rosemary moving and just in the public enough to know that she was there, but out of reach of the public so no one would know that she had disabilities.
There's this interesting little story you tell. It was really important for Rose that Rosemary and Kick be presented at the British court, like this coming out in front of the king and queen. So it was, you know, it was a big deal, this big fancy, you know, gowns and all of that. And Rosemary almost makes it. She trips and nearly fell in front of the king and queen.
Right.
That's an interesting story. Would you say something about that?
So they prepared Rosemary for 2 weeks ahead of this incredible event where she would be introduced to the king and queen of England. And she practiced the curtsy and how to hold her flowers and the right dances and the right little, you know, conversation chatter that she would have to say while she was there. And so there was so much pressure on her, and she goes up to meet the king and queen and has to do her curtsy, and she almost tumbles. I can just feel Rose's heart sinking. But Rosemary saved it. She did not fall, and she was gracious and beautiful, and the press just loved Rosemary. I think the way the Kennedys tried to keep her so quiet and not talking very much made her more alluring to the press. and she was stunningly beautiful. And they wrote a lot about how beautiful her dress was and how beautiful she was. Of course, in Rose's diary and journal, she wrote that she was irritated about that because she thought that Kick's dress was just as beautiful. And of course, the unspoken part was that Rose's dress was just as beautiful, but the press didn't really talk about that too much. They talked about Rosemary because she was stunning. She really was.
Yeah, Rose doesn't come off very well in this story. I mean, I have to say, and we can come back to that actually, but you know, we should also say Rose wore white, and that was not... That should not have been done. She was a debutante, wore white, not Rose. She blew it in that one.
That's right. She did. She did. But she thought she was the most beautiful. So I don't know what you can do. You know, and I know I'm hard on Rose, but I have to give Rose credit for many things that she did do that were positive for Rosemary, like making sure that she was included in as much of the family activities as possible when she was a child. So her siblings learned about inclusion and tolerance and acceptance and helping someone who is not quite as capable as you are. So those children were raised with concepts and ideas that were not the norm at the time. And of course, that would influence them as adults later on. But on the other hand, Rose also just wanted Rosemary sort of put away and hidden away so she wouldn't have to deal with her, particularly as she became a teenager and a young adult.
Right. The story seems to be headed in one way, and then it sort of diverges. It seems like things are going to go reasonably well. I mean, she finds this terrific school in England, the Assumption Convent School. It was a Montessori school. And say something about that, because this is the – maybe I think for the first time in her life, people who really understood her and really gave her a kind of a quality education.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Mother Isabel Eugenie, who was the mother superior at this convent school, had been trained personally by Maria Montessori. And when she took Rosemary into the school, she applied those educational concepts to helping Rosemary learn and become less anxious about learning. And she set achievable goals and paths to achieving those goals for Rosemary. And Rosemary blossomed.
Yeah.
It was remarkable. This woman was amazing with Rosemary. And I, you know, it's tragic because Rosemary probably could have lived there and been with those nuns and been part of their school for the rest of her life if it had not been for World War II interceding.
Right. I found it interesting that Joe Kennedy, whom we all, I'm sure, know, was pretty ambivalent about the U.S. getting involved in the war. And this little tidbit that you put in the book was fascinating. He thought that eventually Rosemary could return to the Assumption Sisters Convent, whether or not the Nazis won the war.
I know. He seemed so cavalier about it. Like, okay, if Germany takes over England, who cares? We'll just come back. It was very strange that he thought that. Very strange.
So Rose Kennedy had sort of gotten used to not having to deal with Rosemary. So she starts looking for these summer camps. And it seems to, this is interesting to you. I guess you're saying that life under the care of those nuns in England, where she's really happy, that was in some ways a better life for Rosemary than life with her mother, who could be demanding and pretty impatient.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And Rose did not want to have to deal with taking care of Rosemary when she was sent back from England in the summer of 1940. And she set up this junior counselor position at a camp in Western Massachusetts. And once again, Rose lied to the two women who ran the camp, did not tell them that Rosemary had intellectual disabilities. She led them to believe that Rosemary could be a junior counselor, sort of like a teacher for these little children at the camp. But the women who ran the camp found out within just a very short period of time that Rosemary was not capable of being a junior counselor. And they felt very, very betrayed by Rose.
Yeah. And Rosemary is sad. I mean, she really, you say in the book that her sense of purpose and self-determination was kind of gone after she was forced to leave England.
Right. I mean, the two women couldn't be taking care of Rosemary and all these little children at the same time. Yeah. So they asked Rose to come get Rosemary. And Rose, you know, just ran away from that job and sent Eddie Moore to get Rosemary. And Rosemary is crushed. The letters from her to the camp counselors and to the two women are just heartbreaking. She just... she's just so upset that she feels that she's disappointed everybody, yeah. and she doesn't really understand why. And oh, my heart just breaks thinking about how that poor young woman felt. And her mother really abandoned her, and her father wasn't there because he was still in England. Mm. She was very, very alone. Very alone.
The letters between Joe and Rosemary, or at least Rosemary's letters to her father, are sad too. Because, and again, I mean, I don't know, I'm trying to put it in the context of the time and give Joe and Rose some kind of break. But, you know, Joe is worried that she's becoming fat. You know, he kind of obsesses over it. She's like, I'm trying to lose weight. I'm trying to make you. I mean, it's almost like she couldn't win. And some of those letters just seemed terrible.
I know. Well, the Kennedys were obsessed with weight,
yeah.
particularly Rose.
Right.
But Joe didn't want his daughters being overweight. And Rosemary had a tendency, I guess, to put on a few pounds. She always looked beautiful in photographs to me. But, you know, rather than praising her about these goals that she was achieving at the Assumption School in England, he was always bringing up her weight, and he brought it up to the nuns that were taking care of her, like, you know, stop feeding her this and make sure she does this. And it's heartbreaking. And she writes to her father and it's like, dear daddy, I love you so much, I don't want to disappoint you. And she can never win, never, never win.
Yeah, she became tense and irritable, you say, and irrational. Some of her tantrums became violent. She started experiencing convulsions. It seems like we're headed for a really bad point here. I mean, this story is, again, it's headed for a collision. I mean, it heads for this lobotomy, which we'll talk about, but her life was getting worse and worse, it seemed, at this point.
Right. They could not find an appropriate setting for her to live in once she came back to the United States, and she went from several different convent situations. And here's this, you know, 22, now 23-year-old woman who's in convent schools where they have teenagers. And she's frustrated and she wants a life of her own. And she's, you know, escaping from these convent schools. And I think her mental health is seriously declining. I know that Rose tried to have her committed to a psychiatric hospital in October of 1941, just before the lobotomy was performed. So there were desperate things that were happening, and Joe and Rose were, you know, at a loss as to what to do. And they were desperate as well.
Desperate. And she was lovely and voluptuous. And as you said, 23, and she's getting a lot of attention from men. Now, this is really interesting. You write in the book that in a household that had a highly sexualized men and also notably repressed women, Rosemary's beauty was a special threat. Would you talk about that?
She was very beautiful and did attract a lot of attention. And I think she was feeling her womanhood and her sexuality and not knowing what to do with it, because no one's telling her what to do about it or how to manage it. And locking her up in a convent school was not going to take care of that. So for Rose and Joe, their greatest fear was that she would be caught in a compromising situation with a young man, or someone would blackmail them or kidnap her, or, you know, heaven forbid, she might get pregnant. So they were looking for ways to prevent that from happening. And I think the lobotomy becomes the choice, unfortunately.
Yeah. Which we'll talk about when we get back from a break. Kate Clifford Larson is with us. Her book is Rosemary, The Hidden Kennedy Daughter. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Kate Clifford Larson. We're talking about her book, Rosemary, The Hidden Kennedy Daughter. She's joining us from a studio outside of Boston. Let's talk about psychosurgery, or at least this idea that leads us to the lobotomy in Rosemary Kennedy's story. Explain what it was that was thought about the inner workings of the brain at this point that made people think a lobotomy could be a cure.
They believe that if they cut the fibers to the frontal lobes, where the emotional center sort of the brain is, that it would release people from being tormented by mental illness, and mental illness in the most broad sense.
Yeah.
So there were these two men, Walter Freeman and Dr. James Watts, who was a neurosurgeon, started working on this procedure that had been developed, the prefrontal lobotomy, in Europe in the mid-1930s. And they were doing their, I'm going to call them experiments because that's what they were, on live patients at George Washington University Hospital in Washington, D.C., where Joe had now returned and was living and working, and where Rosemary was living in a convent. And they had started advertising, in a sense, about this procedure. They claimed that the procedure, you know, liberated people from these terrible illnesses, and it helped them go on to live independent, full lives. But when I looked at their research, it was the exact opposite. Most of their patients ended up disabled, could not live independently. Some of them became horrifically disabled, and some died. But they didn't tell the press that. And unfortunately, there were no medical standards for research. And there was, women could be forced into surgery like this by fathers, husbands, brothers. There were no patient protections at all, no protocols, nothing. So there was really no one to follow up and no one to protect Rosemary, except the American Medical Association at the time came out and said that the surgery should not be done on human beings until more research had been done. And the Catholic Church said that they didn't want their hospitals performing the surgery. They didn't think it was right.
Which tells you something about how desperate Rose Kennedy must have been about all of this, the fact that the Catholic Church had a statement. What's interesting about Walter Freeman, he ends up at some point, you say that over time he ended up performing thousands of these procedures. At one point you said he was doing something like 20 of these a day. But he was not a surgeon. He was a psychiatrist.
No. He was a psychiatrist, and he eventually created the procedure that just used sort of a modified ice pick through the eye socket. But the procedure that Rosemary had, they had to drill on the sides of her head so that it was much more involved and very scary. And I describe it in the book that she had to be awake and how frightening it must have been for her to have this occur to her while she was awake. And then,
I just want to mention a few of the, it's pretty disturbing, so we don't have to spend a lot of time. But you talk about how, as you say, they had to be awake. Some patients would say that they wanted to die right there. Others were calling for help. It sounds medieval. I mean, it sounds horrific.
It was horrific, and it was medieval. And that's what's shocking, that Joe would force her daughter to have this procedure. Just horrific.
Rose has reservations about this, and she says to Kick, to Kathleen, check this out. Let's investigate this. And Kick goes and does that. And this is, of course, before it happens. And she says, Mom, this is a bad idea.
Right. So Rose, in various interviews later in her life, at first said she had no idea. Then eventually she says, well, she had some idea, but Joe did it without her permission. And I think that's actually what happened, that she did have an idea that Joe was considering it. She found out from Kick that it wasn't a good idea. She did not give her permission, but Joe went ahead and had Rosemary lobotomized anyway. So, you know, Rose played a role, but I'm sure that this is not what she planned for her daughter. Her most horrific part in this, I think, is that she did not see Rosemary again for 20 years.
Yeah.
And I can't understand how a mother could not see their child for 20 years.
No. These questions kind of haunted me, I have to say, that you ask in the book. And there's no answer for them. I guess not anyway. Did Joe tell his daughter she was going to have the surgery? Did she ask him questions about it? Did he convince her that this was her decision, but he wanted her to do it? You know, did he manipulate her? Did he tell her that her behavior was a family embarrassment? You know, what did Rosemary think about all of that? I mean, those are huge questions, and I guess we don't really know the answer to them.
Yeah, we don't know the answer. We can speculate, but we don't know the answer. All I know is that she never wanted to disappoint her father, and he probably asked her to do this for him, so she submitted to it but I can't imagine what was going through her whole being while it was occurring. And did she have a sense of being betrayed by her father? I don't know. But I can't imagine what it felt like to be on that table and having that surgery happening while she was awake.
Who went with her? Who was with her when she went through that?
We have no idea. We have no idea.
You know, it raises the question. I wondered if it wasn't Eddie Moore and his wife, Mary. And you mentioned Eddie Moore. We should mention this was his godfather. Eddie Moore was a business partner, dear friend of the family of Joe Kennedy's. And you say earlier in the book that this relationship, Eddie Moore and his wife, Mary, they provided what you call the most important bond of all for Rosemary Kennedy.
Right. They often spent a lot of time with Rosemary, particularly as she got older and the family was traveling in Europe and doing different things. Eddie and Mary Moore would often take Rosemary on trips, or they would accompany her wherever she went. And so you're right. Eddie Moore and Mary could have taken her to George Washington University Hospital for this procedure. We just don't know. We have no idea.
What do we know of the siblings and what they could and couldn't say to their parents about what had happened to Rosemary? I think it was President Kennedy, it was John Kennedy, who was the first to finally see Rosemary. And that took, I think that took 20 years, didn't it, as well?
It was about 16 years in 1958.
Years.
Yeah, when he was on the campaign trail, he took a secret trip to Wisconsin and saw her for the first time. And Eunice, their sister Eunice, said in an interview that it was 10 years before she knew where Rosemary was. The family just didn't talk about it. And Senator Kennedy, Teddy, he was 9 years old when this happened.
Yeah.
And he wrote in his memoir that he was so upset because Rosemary suddenly disappeared. No one told him what happened, but he knew that he had to behave or he might disappear too. That's tough on a 9-year old. And so the family just didn't talk about it.
Did President Kennedy ever say anything at all about his sister?
He only admitted, when he became president, he did admit that he had a sister who was intellectually disabled. And that was at the urging of Eunice, who had grown into a woman and had started becoming very active in the world of promoting research into the causes of intellectual disabilities. And she had yet to start the Special Olympics, but she was the power behind getting things to change in the government, getting the government to start funding research. And she pushed her brother to sign some important legislation mm-hmm. towards that end. And so he did admit it when he was in as a president. But none of them admitted that Rosemary had a lobotomy.
What do we know of when her mother finally, when Rose Kennedy finally does see her daughter? What do we know of that visit?
Well, we know that Rosemary was enraged and yelled mm-hmm. and then hit her mother. Just, you know, that frustration. Can you imagine knowing you're away from your family? No one comes to see you. Your mother doesn't come to see you for 20 years. Now, Rosemary ended up completely disabled after the surgery. She
right.
couldn't walk or talk. She was incontinent. It was terrible. Eventually, once she was moved to Wisconsin to St. Coletta's school, she regained the use of her limbs and she could move around more and she started learning to talk a little bit. But she never forgot who she was. She never forgot her siblings and her parents. She never forgot her former life. So to be abandoned like that, I can't imagine what that felt like. So all that rage came out when she saw her mother for the first time in 1962.
You write that you were surprised. You would have figured that, as I mentioned in the introduction, that the particulars of this story of a family member who had intellectual and mental impairment, that was no longer something to hide, that would have been gone in the 21st century anyway, you know, when word, you know, when she died in 2005. But do you think in some way, even then when she died, and is it reflective of the fact that there wasn't much said in that obituary, in the Boston Globe of all places, that there was in fact still something to hide, that there was some stigma that persisted in some way?
I still feel that there is some stigma, particularly the mental illness part of Rosemary's life. We've come a long way with issues surrounding intellectual disabilities and resources and support and community support, mainstreaming children into classrooms. But with mental illness, we're still struggling. And I think for the Kennedys, and I experienced this while researching at the Kennedy Library, there's a resistance to release some of the papers surrounding Rosemary's story. Mm. But you would think in the 21st century that it's okay, we need to be talking about these issues. We all know that Rose and Joe were deeply flawed people. They, you know, and they had many children who did amazing things who are also flawed. But it's time to discuss the real issues and make sure these things don't happen again. And when it comes to mental illness, we're not there. And I think the Kennedy family could help us all kind of move this conversation forward. And Rosemary can be part of that.
Yeah. You write in an author's note that in the book that as a mother of a disabled child, you're grateful to Rosemary, of course, and to her siblings, Eunice in particular, Senator Ted Kennedy as well. But I think as you've already made clear, but not to her mother, you understand maybe the decisions that she made. You put them in context in the book, but you do come down mystified, I guess, of the how a mother and how a father could actually treat a child like that, I guess.
Right. I'm not willing to let them off the hook by saying, oh, it was just the times. They had tremendous resources. They were among the wealthiest in the country. They had access to so many, not only financial resources, but resources of the Catholic Church and their political connections. There's so much more they could have done for Rosemary rather than have her lobotomized. And that's what they chose to do. That's very frustrating, and they could have made a difference for other people. I think Joe could have ruined the careers of those two doctors who performed the surgery, but he didn't. He just said nothing. And the way that they didn't tell the Rosemary siblings what happened, I think was cruel and very scary. So I think there's a lot to blame Joe and Rose for. I really do. But their children, I think, were deeply changed and moved by what happened to Rosemary, and they were determined not to repeat the mistakes of their parents.
It's Kate Clifford Larson. Her book is Rosemary, the Hidden Kennedy Daughter. She joined us from a studio in Boston. Kate Clifford Larson, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.